Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to U.S. National Politics. I'm your host, Chauncey Brown. Today's show, Natural Rights and Human Nature. My co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler, author of Locke in America, The Moral Philosophy of the Founding Era. And I'm your host, Chauncey Brown. Today, Natural Rights and Human Nature. How are you today, Dr. Hyler?
I'm doing very well. Happy to be here once again.
Dr. Hyler, you've told me that this show is designed to follow up on what we said in our last show, our two founding principles, how limited was limited government meant to be. You should probably sum up the conclusion you reached last week for us, please.
Okay. I said that if governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, then government cannot claim or come by a power the people themselves do not originally possess. Since no man or number of men have a lawful power to take away or give away what belongs to another, that's a power no government can ever have. It is a power the people don't possess and so cannot delegate to their political representatives. If, as the founders firmly proclaimed, all men are created equal and endowed with, quote, certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, unquote, and that includes the right of property and the right to protect the above rights, then men join together and establish government to protect those rights, to protect themselves in the enjoyment of their natural rights. Government, in short, becomes a protector. It may not transform itself into a provider, taking away the liberty or property of some for the benefit of others. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people recognizes that all people are equal and must be treated as such. For when Congress confers special benefits on some at others' expense, it denies equal justice, equal protection under the law to all. Last week, I also showed how prior to the convening of the Constitutional Convention, popular majorities in the states were violating the property rights of their citizens via mortgage stay laws, emissions of paper currency, and legal tender laws forcing creditors to accept the depreciated currency in lieu of debt. I did not mention last week that accordingly, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution prohibits the states from making, quote, anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, unquote, or pass any law, quote, impairing obligation of contract, unquote, like the state's mortgage stay and legal tender provisions that actually did that. Also, since protection of property necessarily implies a sanctity of contract, that is, protection of all legally binding contractual obligations, the fact that U.S. and state bonds sold to citizens here and abroad to finance the Revolutionary War were still unpaid down to the convening of the Constitutional Convention, here was yet another breach of sacred obligation and a blanket denial of due property rights. All this proves how much the natural rights of Americans meant to the majority of men who came to Philadelphia to establish, quote, a more perfect union, unquote.
That is a very strong case, Dr. Hyler. There's only one problem. Is it really true that we are created equal and endowed with the natural rights John Locke and Thomas Jefferson identified? Your conclusion follows logically and necessarily from your premises. I grant that. But what evidence is there for your underlining premise that all men actually possess the indelible inscribed rights in Jefferson's July 4th Declaration? Is that a fact we can take to the bank in cash?
Well, that's the most important question of all. Are we, each and every one of us, born with the rights to live as we please, do and say what we wish, and simply live and let live. For the past 200 years and longer, two arguments have been advanced to seal the deal, to support the proposition. First, the founders said so. We invoke the words and documents the founders left, arguing, in effect, this was our founding tradition, the basis on which our government was organized. They hold as much truth today, those founding principles, as they did back then. Fine, but how much truth did they hold back then? How did the founders persuade themselves that men are actually born with these natural rights? For one thing, the nation's founders insisted, and today's conservative voices repeat, that natural rights are natural in the sense they are given to us, not by government, but by God. But then they would have to prove that there is a God that creates us all and imbues us with these natural rights. Unfortunately, that can't be done, since religious views and commitments are strictly a matter of faith, not reason. John Locke, who was indeed a devout Christian and member of the Anglican Church, said from the start that our rights came from God. We are the Lord's workmanship, he said, sent into the world by his design and for his purposes. We answer only to him, not to one another. But we also discover these natural rights by studying our God-given nature. That was Locke's view. Locke left us a wholly rational and natural proof for the proposition that we are endowed with certain natural and irrevocable rights. It is based on empirical observation, as are all scientific truths. So whether there is a God in heaven or not, we can discover the principles that should govern our actions and the actions of the governments we erect by observing human nature and the condition in which we all find ourselves.
So in order to validate or verify the fundamental political questions, we will have to talk about a different subject entirely. Is that right?
Yes, Chauncey. And that topic, I hope nobody laughs, is ethics, the rules or principles of morality. The problem is convincing our listeners there's such thing as absolute certain moral rules. Most people will tell you that these questions are merely opinions. Everyone thinks he or she knows right from wrong, and there are as many opinions on the subject as there are people who have them. Well, I reject that conclusion. I used to conduct an experiment in my classes. By a strong show of hands, I would say, and they would assure me that there are no absolute certain moral rules. We all pursue what we please, what feels good. Some follow strict moral rules, others don't. On the contrary, I would tell them, they all share certain undeniable values. No sooner would they dare me to name them than I would explain, as the philosopher Ayn Rand helped me to understand. A value is that which one acts to gain and or keep. And what do we know? They all valued health over illness, peace over war, career success over failure, national safety over perpetual threat of foreign invasion or daily criminal assault. I told them all their values are driven by one overriding end, and that is survival, or rather, the ultimate value, which is life itself. Think about it. Where there is no life, only rocks, earth, sand, and such, like on the moon, there are no values. Life is conditional. It can be sustained only by life-serving actions. That which sustains and enhances life, then, is the good. That which threatens it, endangers it, or makes it more perilous, precarious, or plainly unpleasant is the evil. So much, as Ayn Rand concluded, for the problem of reconciling the is and the ought. Because our lives are conditional, we ought to do what we need to sustain and enhance our lives. This takes us to the basic moral topic. Ayn Rand called her little book of essays on morality, quote, The Virtue of Selfishness, unquote. It was a provocative title, and it was meant to be provocative. She was reacting to the far more popular view that says selfishness is what's wrong with the world. We are taught to believe there's nothing moral about a civilization where everyone is out only for himself or herself, like a bunch of billiard balls knocking and banging together without let up. What is moral, we are taught, is helping others, especially the least amongst us. The Christian duty of sacrifice still has a tight grip on modern culture, no matter how many or few abide by this stricture in daily practice. And I would agree there's nothing wrong with benevolence, generosity, and goodwill to others, especially those who have less. But Ayn Rand asked her readers, what could possibly be wrong with pursuing one's own self-interest? Here's her point. Selfishness is a very abstract and complex concept. It takes a variety of forms. A man may act in his self-interest, one, without harming any other in the process, or two, at others' expense, helping himself by harming others through acts of fraud, outright theft, and even violence. Once make this distinction, and the moral matter gains far more clarity. One must pursue his self-interest. His life and well-being demanded. In fact, every living species acts in its own self-interest, as long as it is healthy, that is, able to. Every living creature can be defined as a being possessing certain needs and definite capacities for satisfying those needs. Man is no exception. Man's needs are far greater than those of the lower species. For any being that possesses it, in fact, consciousness is the basic means of survival. Lower animals act on instinct. Men can't. Their consciousness is volitional. They must choose to think, choose what to think about, and to solve a never-ending series of puzzles in order to continually improve the quality of their lives and avoid calamity. From this understanding comes the moral code men adopt to live successfully on Earth. Virtues are what we adopt in order to acquire the values on which our lives depend.
Can you lay out a number of basic rules that are absolutely suited to guide our choices and actions? Rules you would say all men need to follow in life?
Yes. Those rules are called virtues, the principles that should guide our action. A virtue, as Ayn Rand defined it, is a principle of action implemented to achieve a basic moral value, namely the values necessary to enhance life and find joy and fulfillment in it. But before I describe the seven cardinal virtues Ayn Rand identified and that hold the key to a life well lived, one other confusion concerning selfishness should be cleared up. It's common to say that Americans who aren't politically active, who won't donate a minute of their time or energy to politics, to working for the common good, the public interest, are just too selfish to care. They retreat into their own private worlds and concern themselves with nothing more sublime than what affects them personally, nothing else. Yes, that's what millions of Americans do. But it makes them anything but selfish. While they while away their lives tending to their legitimate private concerns, those who do take the trouble to be politically active proceed to bleed them blind. It's really ironic. The average American will tell you that the politicians are crooks, just out to pursue power and line their own pockets. They make the money they need to run for re-election or win higher office, how? By squandering the public treasury on any collection of special interests willing to fill their campaign coffers in return for the special privileges those politicians have in their power to confer. Well, the average American is right as rain about the politicians. But what is so selfish about allowing the travesty to go on and get more oppressive year by year? Think of it like this. If you're paying upwards of 50% in combined federal, state, and local taxes, and what family isn't, you are already half slave, half free. And tell me, what's American about that? It puts the greater part of the population in a state of perpetual bondage. Let me ask again, what in the devil is selfish about enabling one's public servants to rob one blind? It's time every forgotten American man and woman in the country learned that political apathy is as selfless, that is self-defeating, self-destructive, self-sacrificing an act as anyone can commit in this life. And what you may be sacrificing in the crucible of time is everything you have. For it's not only their prosperity that people will forfeit in the scramble for government loot, but their liberty as well.
For those that are listening to our show, this is U.S. National Politics, today's show, Natural Rights and Human Nature. Our co-host and guest, Dr. Jerome Hyler, author of Locke in America. Doctor, so say our listeners now understand that pursuing happiness is a perfect fine thing to do, as long as we show all due considerations to and never self-consciously harm others in the process. It's a perfectly reasonable way to live, and it is the way most Americans do live. But what are the Pacific down-to-earth guidelines, you call them virtues, that should guide us?
Okay, here goes. First, there is the virtue of honesty. Honesty. That's not just not lying to your parents, spouses, or boyfriend or girlfriend. What I mean by being honest is always seeing the world as it is, not pretending that what is isn't, or that what isn't is. Here's the question. How can we expect to deal with the world effectively, clearly see, and successfully resolve the problems that naturally arise daily if we won't see reality for what it is? That's honesty. Second, there is the virtue of independence. Most people think of this as supporting oneself, not living at others' expense. And that definitely is one aspect of independence. But its deeper meaning consists of standing on your own feet, seeing the world through your own eyes, and not caring what others think about what you see, you say, and you decide to do. Today, our civilization is perishing for want of independence. Just think of our schools and college campuses where young men and women are abandoned, ostracized, cast out, should they express a free thought that goes against the political correct certainties of the mob. How certain can they be, these liberal progressives, if they have to spread their ideas not through persuasion, but through coercion, the threat of ostracism and abandonment? But it's the lack of independence on the part of our millennials and many others that enables so many dangerous lies and libels to get absorbed into the popular culture, as is happening today. So that's honesty, and that's independence. And now the third virtue is integrity. We can view integrity as standing on one's own ground and being true to one's own convictions in action, even if there will be a price to pay for being true to one's beliefs. What good is seeing reality for what it is if we fail to act on all that we see and know to be true? Integrity, in short, is honesty in action, honesty under fire. Those are real-life spiritual needs, conditions we must adapt in order to live well. But to survive and thrive, we must also find ways to satisfy a myriad of material needs, not just spiritual, but material needs. To satisfy our material needs, We need to practice the virtue of productiveness. We have to acquire a suitable residence in a safe locale, procure a steady income, enabling us to acquire all the things on which our comfort, health, and well-being rest, and accumulate sufficient resources to live out our retirement years in stress-free, relaxed, and comfortable surroundings. To accomplish this, men and women choose, hopefully, rewarding careers, which offer ample opportunities for advancement. A young fellow once told me he found the secret of life. He was 11 at the time. He said, "Find something you love to do and then figure out how to make money doing it. That will allow us to enjoy the toil we take on, earn the just fruits of our labor, and subsequently exchange our wealth for all the things that can bring comfort, safety, and convenience to our lives." And that's called an atmosphere of free trade. If we've done all this, lifted ourselves up by our own honest efforts, by exercising self-discipline, ingenuity, courage, learned skills, native talents, and sheer grit, we are prepared to revel in another virtue, the virtue of pride. We can be proud of who we've become and all we've accomplished. The product of that is self-confidence that we are able to live and self-respect that we are worthy of living and enjoying life. In fact, this is simply a way of expressing the sixth virtue, the virtue of justice, that every man and woman should get what he or she deserves, for better or worse. Now, all of these virtues taken together add up to a life rationally lived. It is what the virtue of rationality demands of human beings. To be rational, to live rationally, we must practice these principles without let up. In the long run, nothing good comes from being dishonest, that is, attempting to fake the truth and evade reality. In the end, reality must prevail.
That's quite a lot to observe and consider as we think about our own daily conduct and what makes for sound character. But what does this have to do with our original topic? You said you would explain precisely how we know that men are born with the natural rights the founders proclaimed. As you explained in last week's show, it's those natural, irrepressible rights which all men naturally possess that set the precise limits, the precise limits of government's lawful powers.
While the vast majority of the founding generation faithfully believed their rights came from their maker, from God, many steeped in Enlightenment science also believed that God gave man his nature as a rational creature. By what was called unaided reason then, men could therefore determine how they were meant to live. Since it would be absurd to think that a supremely wise and purposeful deity created man with such a capacity for intelligent direction, so able to reason and thereby discover his needs and how to satisfy them, only to let men perish after a short while, it's obvious that men were made to live by the circumstances human nature demands, that is, their makeup as rational beings. It is abundantly reasonable for men to discover their needs and their natural purposes and live as they were meant to live. Life is the ultimate purpose, and so the ultimate standard of value. That which enhances it is the good, that which impedes it, the evil. The virtues needed to satisfy our needs are as discussed: honesty, independence, integrity, productiveness, justice, and pride. Those who live by these virtues live rationally. Now, in a social context, men must be allowed to live as they were meant to live. That means they need to be free to so go about their lives. That is why liberty is an essential requirement of life, as essential as rationality. Consider this: to prohibit anyone from acting as he thinks he should, acting on what he understands to be right, is to prohibit him from using his rational powers. It is an assault on his mind as much as an assault on his actions or behavior. So men, all men, and women too, must be free to follow the path they are on. And so, as we observed last week, Locke comes to the conclusion, quote, "The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, and reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind who will but consult it that being all equal, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions," unquote. Not in government, not out of government. Again, quote, "For there is nothing more evident than that creatures of the same species and rank, promiscuously born to the same advantages of nature, should be equal one amongst another, without subordination or subjection. And this is the understanding that precisely set the boundaries, the strict limits, of every government's lawful powers." Here is Locke: "For nobody can transfer to another more power than he has in himself, and nobody has an absolute arbitrary power over any other to take away the life or property of another. And having in the state of nature no arbitrary power over the life, liberty, or possessions of another, but only so much as the law of nature gives him to the preservation of himself, this is all he does or can give up to the commonwealth, so that the legislative can have no more power than this." Now, I would just say in conclusion that when Thomas Jefferson said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, etc.," he was woefully mistaken. There is nothing self-evident about the fact that all men are created equal and endowed with these natural rights. For most of human history, and in most of the world today, no one even acknowledges these natural rights all men have, whether living in government or out of government. So the truths are not self-evident. But the entire line of argumentation I've presented since the beginning of this broadcast is the proof, is the rational validation of the fact that we do have rights, never mind self-evidence.
Dr. Hyler, I want to thank you very much for this insightful lesson today. Unfortunately, we are closed for time. For people that would like to hear our past podcast and this podcast, you may visit us at blogtalkradio.com/US National Politics. We want to thank Dr. Hyler, and we want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today. And please join us next Tuesday at 4 o'clock for another show about American and liberty and justice. Thank you very much, Dr. Hyler, and thank you all.
Thank you, Chauncey. Until next week.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir.